Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson, and we're just talking about how reliability really starts at the top of an organization. There's some really spectacular case studies, especially some recent ones, which just show how important your leadership and strategy is for making reliability a thing.
You know, I know where you're going with this one, but I think it doesn't have to start at the top. I think I would modify that statement to it has to be supported from the top. I think, and from my own experience, and I know you've done this and successfully and unsuccessfully, is that an individual within the organization, even a lowly reliability engineer, can alter the culture. But it'll be dashed if the senior management goes off in a radically different direction. So I don't think it can start there. It's better if it starts there, but it doesn't have to. I think it's maintained or supported or encouraged or facilitated with senior management.
Yeah, I mean, I have a slightly different perspective. I've got a much more sort of I view. I think leadership of most organizations is responsible for a lot more than we care to acknowledge. Even just setting a culture where ideas filtering up from the ranks, so to speak, is a common practice, common culturally accepted thing to do. Mm-hmm. In a way, that then means that it has started at the top. A leader has created a culture where ideas that start at the bottom are well received. That, in a way, from my perspective at least, it really does start at the top, not challenging what you're saying.
Well, no, I agree. And especially, I'm thinking of Hewlett-Packard, Bill and Dave. When they had 100 employees, they spent time talking to everybody pretty much every day. And eventually they stopped bringing donuts in every day. They went to Fridays only. But they coined the term early on of open door policy. And nobody has doors. I mean, there's conference rooms with doors, but there's offices do not have doors. And when they said it's an open door policy, they meant it. It wasn't, and that started obviously at the top, and it created a culture of you share ideas and you get feedback, and it was the way it was implemented by mid managers was hit or miss in my experience of how well that was adhered to, but it was a palpable different culture than what I'd seen in other organizations.
Yeah, and we were just talking topical conversation is what's happened recently at Boeing. We've seen some spectacular critical failures.
I just saw something the other day. I just saw the headline of it is that the 737 is still having a raft of issues, even though it's been brought back into use again. They're still going after it. And now one of the news stories I heard the other day was part of one of the aircraft was certified by the French government, and FAA just kind of took a pass on it. So I know Boeing is a big company and highly regulated and all that stuff, but they just seem to have lost their way in creating a reliable aircraft.
Yeah. And I mean, when the dust settles on some of these collapses of companies or collapses of perception or collapses of prestige, whatever you want to call it, there tends to be some very obvious markers that when you look back again with the benefit of hindsight, you go, how could you have missed that? I mean, Dennis Muilenburg, the then CEO, he got fired essentially over this, but you can easily read articles which are authored in 2014 and 2016 and 2017 before the Boeing aircraft crashes in the last two or three years, and there were warning signs. I mean, he initiated this thing called Partnering for Success, which is essentially insisting that suppliers cut their costs somewhat arbitrarily. And if they didn't, they'd be quite literally blacklisted, and it was colloquially called pilfering for success. and suppliers aren't, you and I both know, a lot of suppliers aren't operating on huge profit margins. So when they are faced with selling their products for less money or going bankrupt, it's a really easy choice of cutting corners, skipping steps, and giving providing things to the customer that you nominally say they do what they do, but in practice, all the stuff that was previously being paid for is not in there. Something has got to give.
Mm-hmm.
You could also argue that Boeing is very adversarial commercially in terms of what they were doing with Bombardier, lobbying for lobbying for trade restrictions on external external would-be competitors. All this stuff, which takes them away from designing good aircraft. It was all this second order stuff, taking money, trying to dominate markets, trying to, let's just say, ease the FAA or regulatory burden as much as possible by trying to do it for them.
Mm-hmm.
And initially the shareholders loved it because they weren't expending costs the way they were used to, and the profits were going through the roof. But we know now there's whistleblowers saying we can't keep producing aircraft at this rate and be comfortable that they're safe. And that was borne out by essentially physics later on.
Yeah. Well, it extends beyond Boeing, though. I on a rant about procurement cost cutting without concern for performance in the field. Yet when it's driven, and I wonder if this Muhlenberg, if he's was an MBA or an engineer.
He's an engineer.
Oh, no excuse, dude.
I know.
It's like
worked his way up from the bottom.
Wow, no excuse. And I don't know enough about Boeing and Boeing's culture. I know they're a big employer. I know that their engineers are unionized, and I don't know what, if any, effect that has on it. And I even used one of the textbooks written by I think he's retired now, but he's, and I'm drawing a blank on his name. He wrote Design of Experiments and Reliability,
mm-hmm.
kind of a mixture of a book. And I thought it was well done. But I have no idea if that was implemented within the company. And I knew one engineer through RAMS that she spent a lot of time doing physics of failure type stuff and modeling, trying to get the aerospace standards to use that versus the parts count methods. But it's just back to the idea that the culture drives it. And I know that that's true. I don't know. I'm kind of glad I don't travel for business anymore. It's one part of it, but you know, it's still the safest form of transportation all overall. It makes the news because it's very rare. It's a balance for me. It's like, yeah. I'd like it when an aircraft will always make it there with a very, very small probability of failing and falling out of the sky. That's good. And it does cost money to do that. It takes time and energy to do it. But I think the message to me, the way you explained it, Chris, is that you can't really just focus on one aspect of your business without a balance or a counterweight so that you don't cross some thresholds. Right. Whether it's reliability or other things, you can cost cut yourself right out of business.
Is almost what happens.
Yeah.
But the good thing here is, I mean, when people are very proud of their organizations that they work with, think Boeing, NASA's another example. But in the case of Boeing, it's not as if there were engineers who weren't identifying problems. There were borderline whistleblowers saying, "Hey, this is not cool." So mm-hmm. this is not people who work in organizations where they have these spectacular, catastrophic, critical failures, they do share some of the I suppose guilt by association, and because they're proud in their organization, proud of their own work, and that's to be commended. But in practice, we know that there were plenty of people saying, hey, this is not going to work. Think about NASA. I mean, the two space shuttle disasters, they failed due to failure mechanisms or causes or modes that NASA had known about for at least 15 years before that particular those two catastrophes occurred. So it's not like there weren't engineers, competent engineers at the coalface looking at what was going on and saying, hey, we've got to do something about it. It was the leadership culture, the management style, whatever it was, that drove decision-making in a very bad way. In NASA's case, it was a very obvious case of management just directly overruling sound engineering advice. And that comes back to my main point. Reliability starts at the top. You had, in that case, you had NASA in particular, you had engineers who were saying, hey, this is what we need to do. But the leaders weren't allowing those great ideas you mentioned, Fred, percolate from the bottom up.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was, I suppose, an idea that started at the bottom. Yeah, for me, I always like characterizing it as it starts at the top. They have to start creating this environment where things are challenges to the status quo are welcomed, great ideas are valued, and subordinates are listened to. If not, bad things happen.
Yeah. I want to balance this out a little bit. I remember I worked when I was at Hewlett Packard, in the group I was in, we had a small amount of money in the group that could be used for R&D projects. So we weren't working internally for a client, you know, and delivering what they agreed to pay for. We had small funds to explore whatever topics. And every year they would say, all right, submit your ideas for consideration. And and one year they advertised that, you know, the more ideas, the better. This is a brainstorm. I'm like, okay, cool. And of course, Helen, who sat next to me in the office, next door to me, she said, I've already put 25 in. How are you doing? And so we egged each other on, and we each put in over 50 ideas for project proposals. And my boss came to me with this stack of paper he printed out and goes, what are you doing? I have to go in there and explain each one of these and sort out which ones are good or not. And I don't understand any. And I was like, okay, well, you shouldn't really be in that position, you know, kind of thing. But it can start at the top. The director of our group wanted ideas and get people engaged in thinking through, you know, stuff that they wanted to fund to explore and develop. And that's where the reliability group came out of and a handful of other projects I did. But the senior manager, she got it. She would just stop by the desk and how's it going? And she would ask questions, and she was savvy as an engineer and could help me frame problems and understand stuff. So I always enjoyed the conversations with her. But the mid-managers,
I think you mentioned her a few times. Yeah.
Oh yeah. But the mid-managers one was afraid to make decisions, and another one wouldn't listen to anybody. He was busy doing engineering work and didn't do anything for the group. And, you know, and
yep.
I had a couple of good ones and some really bad ones. So it's not just the top. It's how does the top nurture that culture along and make it, get it implemented and make it consistent. And part of it, one of the things I see in some organizations is, quality and reliability is important. We're going to say that until we're blue in the face. But when we walk into the vendor's site, we're going to say, cut the cost, cut the cost, cut the cost.
Yeah.
And by the way, keep the reliability good. But we don't define what we want and stuff like that. And I took that away, that experience away, and said, you know, it's, if you focus just on cost cutting, or if you focus just on time to market, or you focus on any one thing to the exclusion of other things, you're going to cross thresholds, right? If we want to get to time to market, we may deliver a product that just is not ever going to be profitable, you know, at any price point or whatever. But if you don't set boundaries and thresholds that are well known and understood, the drive to a single focus is, it does provide emphasis on a single topic or outcome that's desired in the organization. But I think it's short-sighted to do it to the exclusion of any other boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And reliability is the same. You can't just focus on reliability. We would never launch a product if we do that.
Well, I did one of the articles I've recently written on Ascendo was the contrasting things that you as a person want versus things that you as a person like the idea of, because mm-hmm. they're very different. If people say they want to be fit and healthy, but if you're not prepared to stop eating burgers, then being fit and healthy is something they like the idea of, but they don't want. If you want something, you're going to prioritize it. You're going to earn it. You're going to do something a bit. You're going to give of yourself. If you're not giving of yourself, then whatever it is we're talking about is something you just like the idea of. Sure, if it comes along, it's going to be a good thing, but you're not going to go out and earn it. And that's where your man or woman who banged their fist in the desk saying quality is our number one priority, safety is our number one goal, reliability is nothing more important than reliability and quality and all those things. But when they go into the supplier negotiation, say, we just want you to cut costs, essentially quality, safety, and reliability are things they like the idea of, but they don't truly want. What they truly want is reduce costs now. And there's a real difference. And I challenge people and leaders out there to try and create two buckets, a bucket of things they want, a bucket of things they like the idea of. It might be enlightening. If you're not prepared to earn the thing that you think you want, then it goes into the bucket of things you like the idea of. And that's just the way it is. And the reality is those things you like the idea of are never going to happen because they just don't magically appear.
Yeah. One of the things how much did Boeing end up losing roughly due to the 737 groundings?
Geez, I don't know. It wasn't insignificant.
The number like $20 billion comes to my mind or something like that, which isn't, mm-hmm. and it may be more or not. I don't know off the top of my head. I don't remember the exact number, but you know, 6 years ago, there may well have been somebody said, hey, look, this is going to cause a grounding and lost sales. And I can already hear the argument. It goes, well, that's a very, these aircraft are safe. And it was very remote possibility this happened. We have, you know, 250,000 components loosely organized in a flying machine. You know, which one are you talking about and what's the evidence? And yeah, that's a 1 in a million chance and blah, blah, blah. We'll take that risk as that's just not going to happen. And even though it has a finite probability of happening of a big major disaster recall kind of thing, it's rare with a big consequence. And I've heard it a number of times. Well, that's why I'm in the manager, we're going to make a decision that accounts for that risk and we'll take that risk. You know, if you come in here and have evidence that 50% of the aircraft will crash on takeoff, yeah, we'll deal with that. But when it's 1 in a million chance, there's a lot of 1 in a million chances. We can't fix them all. And so the logic then spins out of control where then that 1 in a million becomes 1 in 100,000. And the validity of the investment in understanding the risks gets deteriorated. And why bother telling anybody? Because they're going to ignore it anyway.
Well, what you just said then, that sort of thought process, going back to NASA, was exactly what happened in the NASA organization for those space shuttle failures. Because that's a world without data in terms of hard, demonstrable data. We can't... sure, there's lots of testing, but there's no, you can't demonstrate an external tank failure or what a foam strike has done to a leading edge using field data because the reliability demands are relatively high. But each commission, when they went into what happened, they noticed that the managers thought there is like a 1 in 10,000, a 1 in 100,000 risk of failure, probability mm-hmm. of failure. The engineers were in the order of 1 in 50 to 1 in 100.
Okay, so it was being padded a bit as their risk perception.
Right, and we now know that those engineers' estimates were very much on the money. Yep. So when there's people can easily talk themselves out of risk-based scenarios when there's no data because
we do that every day when you get in your car or get on the highway.
Well, I mean, I don't know about that, because you go on the highway, we know how many, you know, we can go online and work out what the chance of dying per kilometre you drive is. And I think even when you know that, you're going to make a risk-based decision to keep living your life. That's mm-hmm. still informed. But with the 737 MAX and the space shuttles, we're talking about thing that essentially new developmental features that hadn't been tested before. So we're talking the MCAS system. That was a new bit of kit, which, and going back to what Boeing was doing, it was essentially saying, well, this is actually a variation on an existing airframe. Therefore, we don't need to go through the full certification process.
Right. Right.
But in practice, it was a brand new subsystem, which
took control of the aircraft. And
right.
So, yeah. No, I know what you're saying. And it's, I think the takeaway really is that, I mean, be careful what you focus on. And my guidance is make sure that there are strong guardrails of don't cross this threshold or stuff. But what I think what you're getting at here, Chris, is that the culture, even if you want to focus on cost reduction, the culture still needs to be there, that you can hear the warning signs, you can understand where, how that gets implemented. It's if you set up an adversarial, you know, damned or torpedoes full steam ahead, the bad things can happen and do happen in organization after organization. But it's the culture around balancing that, I think, is my main takeaway from this.
Yeah, and although we might characterize it slightly differently, like I said, reliability starts at the top. From my perspective, it's the reason I say it is because that culture you're talking about, where those great ideas are able to percolate from the bottom, that starts with the leader. We might be good reliability initiatives might technically start at a lower level, but they will die a very abrupt death if that culture, which the leadership team owns, doesn't support those ideas mm-hmm. as they progress through the organization,
yep.
which is, I think, we furiously agree on.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. All right. Well, it's a, if anybody knows how much Boeing lost from the 737 experience recently, let us know. Oh, and by the way, Chris, I added a feature to our comment mm-hmm. field on the ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. There's always been a text field. You can send us a comment. But I recently ran across a free service that allows you to record an audio clip. And so it's good for 90 seconds. And I mean, for per recording, and then it sends me an email with the recording, and we'll hear your question live. And then if, you know, it makes sense to talk about it in a podcast, which I most often would think it would, mm-hmm. we'd just add that to the clip, to the podcast. I think that would be kind of cool to actually hear our listener's voice. So here's a quick plug to go to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there's a link there now that allows you to hit record, and it'll pick up whatever speaker you have set up for your system, and you can record a question or a comment for us. And in this case, we would actually hear your voice. So we would love to hear you, your questions or comments. So head over to go/SOR and let us know your thoughts. And you may hear yourself actually part of the conversation on an upcoming episode. I think that'd be cool.
That'd be super cool.
All right. So with that, Chris, we'll see what kind of audio clips we get in for questions, and we'll work with that.
Fantastic. Till next time, Fred. Good talk.
Hey, cheers. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.